French rivalry was defeated, as we've already told, and by 1798, Lord Mornington, afterwards the Marquess Wellesley, the elder brother of that General Wellesley who became the Duke of Wellington, became Governor General of India and set the policy of the company definitely upon the line of replacing the fading empire of the Great Mogul by its own rule. Napoleon's expedition to Egypt was a direct attack upon the empire of this British company. While Europe was busy with the Napoleonic Wars, the East India Company, under a succession of governors general, was playing much the same role in India that had been played before by Turkoman and such like invaders from the north, but playing it with a greater efficiency and far less violence and cruelty. And after the Peace of Vienna, it went on, levying its revenues, making wars, sending ambassadors to Asiatic powers, a quasi-independent state, a state, however, with a marked disposition to send wealth westward. In a previous chapter, we've sketched the breakup of the empire of the Great Mogul and the appearance of the Maratha states, the Rajput principalities, the Muslim kingdoms of Oud and Bengal, and the Sikhs. We can't tell here in any detail how the British company made its way to supremacy, sometimes as the ally of this power, sometimes as that, and finally as the conqueror of all. Its power spread to Assam, Sindh, Oud. The map of India began to take on the outlines familiar to the English schoolboy of today, a patchwork of native states embraced and held together by the great provinces under direct British rule. Now, as this strange, unprecedented empire of the company grew in the period between 1800 and 1858, the mechanical revolution was quietly abolishing the great distance that had once separated India and Britain. In the old days, the rule of the company had interfered little in the domestic life of the Indian states. It had given India foreign overlords, but India was used to foreign overlords, and had hitherto assimilated them. These Englishmen came into the country young, lived there most of their lives, and became a part of its system. But now the mechanical revolution began to alter this state of affairs. It became easier for the British officials to go home and to have holidays in Europe, easier for them to bring out wives and families. They ceased to be Indianized. They remained more conspicuously foreign and Western, and there were more of them, and they began to interfere more vigorously with Indian customs. Magical and terrible things, like the telegraph and the railway, arrived. Christian missions became offensively busy. If they didn't make very many converts, at least they made skeptics among the adherents of the older faiths. The young men in the towns began to be Europeanized, to the great dismay of their elders. India had endured many changes of rulers before, but never the sort of changes in her ways that these things portended. The Muslim teachers and the Brahmins were alike alarmed, and the British were blamed for the progress of mankind. Conflicts of economic interests grew more acute with the increasing nearness of Europe. Indian industries, and particularly the ancient cotton industry, suffered from legislation that favoured the British manufacturer. A piece of incredible folly on the part of the company precipitated an outbreak. To the Brahmin, a cow is sacred. To the Muslim, the pig is unclean. A new rifle, needing greased cartridges, which the men had to bite, was served out to the company's Indian soldiers. The troops discovered that their cartridges were greased with the fat of cows and swine. This discovery precipitated a revolt of the company's Indian army, the Indian Mutiny of 1857. First, the troops mutinied at Meerut, then Delhi rose to restore the empire of the Great Mogul. The British public suddenly discovered India. They became aware of that little garrison of British people far away in that strange land of fiery dust and weary sunshine, fighting for life against dark multitudes of assailants. How they got there, and what right they had there, the British public didn't ask. The love of one's kin in danger overrides such questions. There were massacres and cruelties. 1857 was a year of passionate anxiety in Great Britain. With mere handfuls of troops, the British leaders, and notably Lawrence and Nicholson, did amazing things. They didn't sit down to be besieged while the mutineers organized and gathered prestige. That would have lost them India forever. They attacked often against overwhelming odds. "Clubs, not spades, are trumps," said Lawrence. The Sikhs, the Gurkhas, the Punjab troops stuck to the British. The South remained tranquil. Of the massacres of Cawnpore and Lucknow in Oude, and how a greatly outnumbered force of British troops besieged and stormed Delhi, other histories must tell. By April 1859, the last embers of the blaze had been stamped out, and the British were masters of India again. In no sense had the mutiny been a popular insurrection. It was a mutiny merely of the Bengal army, due largely to the unimaginative rule of the company officials. Its story abounds in instances of Indian help and kindness to British fugitives. But it was a warning. The direct result of the mutiny was the annexation of the Indian Empire to the British Crown. By the act entitled An Act for the Better Government of India, the Governor-General became a viceroy representing the sovereign, and the place of the company was taken by a Secretary of State for India responsible to the British Parliament. In 1877, Lord Beaconsfield, to complete this work, caused Queen Victoria to be proclaimed Empress of India. Upon these extraordinary lines, India and Britain are linked at the present time. India is still the empire of the Great Mogul, expanded, but the Great Mogul has been replaced by the crowned Republic of Great Britain. India is an autocracy without an autocrat. Its rule combines the disadvantage of absolute monarchy with the impersonality and irresponsibility of democratic officialdom. The Indian, with a complaint to make, has no visible monarch to go to. His emperor is a golden symbol. He must circulate pamphlets in England or inspire a question in the British House of Commons. The more occupied Parliament is with British affairs, the less attention India will receive, and the more she will be at the mercy of her small group of higher officials. This is manifestly impossible as a permanent state of affairs. Indian life, whatever its restraints, is moving forward with the rest of the world. India has an increasing service of newspapers, an increasing number of educated people affected by Western ideas, and an increasing sense of a common grievance against her government. There's been little or no corresponding advance in the education and quality of the British official in India during the past 70 years. His tradition is a high one. He's often a man of exceptional quality, but the system is unimaginative and inflexible. Moreover, the military power that stands behind these officials has developed neither in character nor intelligence during the last century. No other class has been so stagnant intellectually as the British military caste. Confronted with a more educated India, the British military man, uneasily aware of his educational defects and constantly apprehensive of ridicule, has in the last few years displayed a disposition towards spasmodic violence that has had some very lamentable results. For a time, the Great War altogether diverted what small amount of British public opinion was previously given to India, and drew away the more intelligent military men from her service.